Kaylee Quinn sets a nonprofit standard for having fun while doing a whole lot of good. Kaylee's the executive director of Climate Ride, founded in 2008 after Kaylee had an epiphany that merged her love of outdoor adventure, a trip to China when she became ill, and her passion for environmental advocacy and change. Today, Climate Ride supports over 120 nonprofit organizations by mobilizing participants to protect the planet through life-changing adventures. I've been on several of those adventures and can attest to the effectiveness of Kaylee's approach. Starting from absolute scratch, Kaylee and her team have built a powerhouse nonprofit that not only generates substantial funds for climate initiatives, it also generates a model for motivating and satisfying funding sources. Here's my conversation with Kaylee. Kaylee Quinn from Climate Ride, welcome to the Nonprofiteers Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chip.
Oh, so good to see you again. I was trying to remember the first Climate Ride. I think it was Iceland in 2017. That was a fantastic ride.
Incredible adventure. Can you believe we did that? All of those volcanoes.
And I remember I hadn't ridden my mountain bike in a while. And I think, yeah, I did have it shipped there. You wanted a picture of someone coming up this incredibly steep hill. And so I started up the hill, and about two-thirds of the way up, I couldn't keep going. It was like, so that was, I felt like I was a big disappointment to you, Kaylee.
The fact that you did a ride and keep coming back, you're my hero.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, thank goodness for Jim Custer.
He's our dear friend.
Yeah. So I'm very excited about, you know, you guys are one of my favorite nonprofits in the world. And, you know, I've had a lot of time and experience with nonprofits. So let's start by just talking about the history of Climate Ride, how you came to it in your history a little bit.
Sure. So my background, after finishing college, I decided I wanted to see the world and learn languages. And so I began several years of travel that really began to shape my life. And I ended up working as a guide, a hiking and cycling guide for an active travel company called Backroads. And they sent me all over the world leading trips. And eventually I wound up in China leading bike tours. And this was really my first awakening to the environmental crisis. I had the joy of seeing so many beautiful places on our planet, but often a lot of our pollution and the effects of pollution and climate are hidden from us. I was not alive when the rivers were on fire in the United States and when we passed extraordinary legislation like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. Well, my time in China was my awakening. I was sick all the time from pollution. I was seeing a country that was in a rapid transition to an urban car culture. And when I came back to the United States, I moved to Montana near Glacier National Park, one of the most spectacular.
Lucky you.
I know. And it was really when I first started learning about climate change. Park scientists were talking about the glaciers in Glacier National Park receding. And I thought, gosh, you know, what can I do with my skills as a bike tour guide to have an impact on these issues? So a friend and I decided we wanted to, well, first we said, we'll ride our bikes across the United States and we'll go meet with Congress. And we decided that would not have a big impact. So we started a charitable ride and called it Climate Ride and organized a bike ride from New York City to DC in 2008. And over 100 people signed up. And, you know, this was before smartphones, before, you know, I designed with the help of a friend a website. We got a $5,000 loan from the bank to buy donation software, and we had raised close to $200,000. And then we had everyone meet with their members of Congress in DC, which we helped organize. Yeah. So that first ride was extraordinary, combining adventure with purpose and also being the first to do that for the environment and active transportation.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you really started from scratch.
Oh, 100%, yes.
Totally, totally. Did you have any models in those early days for, and had you had any nonprofit experience?
No nonprofit experience. I would say a model was I saw that some of my friends were starting to do rides that benefited cancer organizations or HIV/AIDS. And I thought, why doesn't that exist? Where's the philanthropy? This idea of pledge a dollar for every mile I bike or run, where is it for the environment? It did not exist at all.
Wow. Yeah. So that's an incredible convergence of things. You getting sick in China, realizing what a big issue climate was, loving adventure biking, loving out the outdoors and cycling. In those early days, what were the big struggles?
The big struggles, you know, I loved the logistics part. I loved the guiding part. I loved the design of websites. I loved communicating people, trying to find sponsors to help launch the organization. And I actually really loved all the aspects of learning how to run a nonprofit. You know, it's a business, you know, there are certain things you need to do to start to establish a business. So I always enjoyed all of those aspects. So in a weird way, I don't know if the right word is weird, they were challenges, but I loved every minute of it. So, you know, I really felt like I was designing something, you know, struggles that you always work with in the nonprofit. I call it the nonprofit mentality. It's this idea that nonprofits should do more with less all the time. You know, it's like, why should you use a new computer when you could use an old software, you know, or why should you make a living wage? You know,
I can tell you the answer to that one, but you probably don't want to hear it. But as an ex CTO guy, you know.
Yeah. So, okay. Oh, you actually know.
Yeah. But anyway, so keep going.
Well, all of those struggles that nonprofits go to, and now with 15 years experience and serving on other boards that work in service to nonprofits, I've certainly become an advocate for the people who run nonprofits to have the support they need to successfully achieve their missions.
Yeah. I love your description of the early days because, you know, if you're doing something new and you love learning, it doesn't have to be onerous. It should be fun in a way, right? Like if it's not fun, you're probably not doing the right thing. Probably not aligned with your preferences and your talents as a human being, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary what, you know, we find fun. I think with Climate Ride, the entire idea of creating transformative experiences, because they really can ignite behavior change. You know, so one of my great joys is all of this background work that our team does, and I get to work with the most wonderful staff members and board members. But then when you're at the events to see that transformation take place in real time is incredibly gratifying.
Yeah. So digging a little bit deeper into the challenges, what were understanding that it was fun. And by the way, the fun thing, that's what I love about Climate Ride. That's why I'd rather work with Climate Ride and donate to Climate Ride than a lot of other nonprofits, because there is a nonprofit mentality, and I've known plenty of these people, where it's, you know, kind of the suffering servant, hyper serious, you know, there are people in the world suffering, and it's devoid of fun. And again, I don't think it has to be. And so what you guys have done is combined fun and stimulation, good stimulation, with great causes.
Yeah, with extraordinary outcomes, in fact, with our grants.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, you know, you ask about the challenges. And when I think about why I started this and why I continue to do it, we have a problem in philanthropy in this country. Americans give over $600 billion a year in charitable giving. And the percentage of that goes to the environment is less than 3%. So I call it the dregs of American philanthropy. And that includes animal welfare. That includes zoos, animal welfare groups, you know, so active transportation doesn't even register on giving in terms of percentage. So I see that as an opportunity. It's a challenge, but it's also because you just need to convince people that donating to the to environmental causes has worthwhile results. And so, you know, with Climate Ride, we learned early on, you know, originally we had, you know, for your viewers to understand how Climate Ride works. When you sign up for an event, you get to choose the nonprofits that you would like the proceeds of your fundraising to go to. So we have a beneficiary list of over 120 groups right now that you can select. And they range from national parks groups to climate action groups, bicycle coalitions, land trusts, wildlife groups, conservation. So a huge range. So when you sign up, you get to choose. And that's an incredibly powerful feeling to empower where those funds raise or go. Because in the environment, there is not like one American Cancer Society for the environment. There's not a huge, enormous, multi-billion dollar NGO, you know, that's addressing a wide variety of environmental issues. They're mainly small and medium-sized nonprofits that affect your local landscape. And we learned that very early on from the feedback of participants. It said, you know, I really love this group you put on the list, but this group is protecting the river in my town. This group is doing the work to protect the corridors around the national parks. And we said, that's really brilliant. Like, you should have the prerogative, the ability to direct those funds. So that was a challenge that we met by finding a very unique solution.
Yeah. That's one of the very attractive things about signing up for a Climate Ride is you probably already have institutions or organizations in mind that you care about. So and you can direct the funding at them. So you said something interesting earlier that environmental issues were kind of a second class citizen in terms of philanthropy historically. Why do you think that is?
Another issue I ran into when I first started is people said to me, I can't fundraise for this cause. My friends and family won't give because it's not like cancer. It doesn't affect them. You know, and so we had to make the case early on that it does affect you. And that was a struggle in the first several years, convincing people, even though they may have believed or had some sense that this is a critical issue, it was that, can I translate it into making an ask? Because you don't have a photo, you don't often have a personal story. And so our team created a lot of language and imagery around that to help fundraisers. And that was really critical early on. Now, I think we're continuing to grow at a strong pace because more and more people are aware of how this is affecting their daily life.
Yeah, the urgency of the climate issue and the scope of it doesn't seem to translate to easy marketing.
Yeah, it's not as easy, but there are solutions to that.
Yeah. So we kind of skipped over this, but mission and vision. Talk about the mission and vision and maybe how it's evolved a little bit. Sure. It feels like it's probably pretty close to the same as it was in the early days, but how would you describe it now?
You know, when we first started out, we ran one event a year for a while, and then we expanded to running up to 15 events a year all over the world. So fundamentally, the idea is we want to mobilize people to protect the planet. And we use this model of life-changing adventures, charitable events, to engage people. We want to move you off the couch, so to speak, to being an active advocate. And our participants, when they do these rides, it's not just the act of them doing the ride, it's the people that they reach out to in the process. So each participant on average reaches out to 60 people to say, this is meaningful to me, this is important to me, will you support me as I take on this journey? So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this behavioral change concept, you know, it's really valuable in terms of igniting people's desire to take the next step, which might be of a wide variety of possibilities. It might be starting to write letters to their members of Congress. It might be volunteering for a group. It might be becoming a bigger donor, which we often see. And it might make greater connections to nonprofits that they weren't aware of. So we see this as sort of a place where people who need a fun and engaging place to meet with people, and also for people who are just kind of making their first step into caring about the environmental and sustainability movement.
Yeah, I love that. The one strong testimony to your approach is that I think I've been on 4 or 5 climate rides now, and I've never been on a single climate ride where I didn't see someone from a previous climate ride, which means people keep coming back. People are doing it over and over again.
We have a very high return rate. And I think that means that people really enjoy this and see this as a great way to spend both their time and their donor dollars.
Yeah. And I can say unequivocally, and this is just like, you know, as the Big Lebowski says, this is just like my opinion, man. I have so much fun on the rides. It's not that I don't think about the climate stuff, but the rides are, if all it was just a ride that you had to pay for, it's worth it. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, can I quote the Big Lebowski too?
Okay, sure.
Climate ride is the rug that ties the room together. So, I mean, it's a valid point. You know, some people have said this is sort of interesting is, I was thinking about this today, you know, at Climate Ride, our team has been able to connect what seem to be very disparate issues, you know, like the people who are funding bison conservation, reintroduction to urban planning, bike coalitions, you know, this enormous umbrella of sustainability. You know, so it's really a holistic approach to environmental philanthropy.
Yeah. Good for you guys. So what are your operational priorities now, Kaylee? What are you guys focused on now? What matters the most to you moving forward?
So we're in such a great phase right now. As I said, you know, we have an incredible staff, small staff. You'd be amazed. We're just 5 people.
And well, I know. And a bunch of other riders, I'm sure, know everyone on your staff, which is it's pretty amazing.
They're very involved in everything. And so right now, what we're really working on is finding the right balance of events. You know, we have our Green Fondo series, which is incredible. And this is a weekend event. That's 2 days, Saturday and a Sunday. And it has a very low fundraising minimum to participate. So it draws in more people. You know, people have more time to attend a weekend event. The fundraising is lower. So it brings in a lot more people, which is so important to growing the cause. But at the same time, it has a lower fundraising amount, right? Some of our smaller events, they might be 20 people, but then they can also really increase our grants program because of the higher fundraising. So we're kind of trying to find this right balance of events. The Green Fondo event, which I just mentioned, we fully underwrite. So Climate Ride, we fundraise from incredible donors so that we can give 100% of every dollar raised on that event away. So just our last event in May, we gave out close to $250,000, just money to grants. And that's very unusual in charitable events and philanthropy. So always trying to make sure that we can raise enough money to do that, because now that's a core program and we want to continue that.
Yeah.
Other things, you know, we discussed this earlier, but how to grow our participant base in the way to engage people who are afraid to engage on climate. You know, it can be so overwhelming and depressing. And part of what we do is create a space where you're re-engaged again. You see the value of learning about the issues and taking action. Yeah. So always working on how to reach new audiences.
Yeah. Yeah. What are the biggest learnings that you've taken away from the, you know, from your role as executive director? Is it executive director or CEO? I want to get that right.
It's executive director.
Okay. So what are the biggest learnings you've taken away? And, you know, they don't have to be from positive outcomes.
Sure.
You know, some of my biggest learnings came from mistakes, but, you know, so I'm interested in what yours were. Learnings, not mistakes.
You mean sort of in terms of managing a nonprofit?
For the benefit of other nonprofit leaders, sure, you know, what are the things that you've learned? You know, what are the principles that you've brought to bear over time nonprofit management?
Definitely. First, I think the way, and this probably came from being a guide where you needed to really rely on your fellow guides in a very equal way. I love the staff that I get to work with. I have a philosophy of not being a top-heavy manager. I always want people to share their ideas, and I will do anything. If they have an idea, I'll help put that into place. You know, there's a lot of creativity that can come from sort of that freedom. And as technically the executive director, I benefit from the creativity in helping my team implement their ideas. So I absolutely love that. I also think as part of that management, you know, we are a company that's focused on protecting the outdoors. And so the outdoors, and in whatever way that manifests for you, is really important. So we have a philosophy at work of working hard, but also getting outside. You know, we have a ski policy.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, we live in Montana. It's gray a lot. It's very cold. But if it's snowing, I expect the people on our staff to get outside and do something, because it's a magical time, and work can be made up later. If it's sunny, which it's not always sunny here, I hope we go out for a walk or a bike ride. So our flexibility in our schedules has been really wonderful. And I think it's led to extraordinary levels of productivity on our team. Are there any more philosophies? Is that?
Oh, I have a couple.
Sure. Okay. First, be very wary of hiring consultants. I think a lot of nonprofits, especially when you're starting out and it's early, there's a sense of, where do I find this expertise to help me do what I need to do? And you know, we've dabbled over the years, but generally it hasn't been necessarily, in certain ways, especially when you have such a tight budget, really the best use of the funds you manage to generate. So I think it's about building a great board of directors. You know, so that's something that I've been a part of, you know, board. And then now our board is really a strong board, and now they are taking on these important roles. So there's just things along the way that you learn. You need, you know, to rely on people who aren't necessarily telling you they know how to run what you're doing. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. You know, consultants are expensive.
Very expensive.
And too often they see themselves as, and they would never phrase it this way, but as hit and run specialists. They come in, they tell you something you need to do, they analyze your operation or your finances or your marketing, and then they tell you, here's what you need to do, X, Y, and Z, implement this. And then they go away. And there are no guarantees, right? And you just spend a ton of money. So it's, you know, as you described it, the board can serve that role. The board can provide a lot of advice and consent, which is, nothing is free, but it's a lot cheaper than, you know, than hiring consultants.
And that's really critical when you're a young nonprofit trying to figure things out. So you either run as becoming the director of a nonprofit, or an idea that you put into action, you know, finding those advocates in the early part of your journey can really be helpful.
I want to go back to something else you said, you know, about your team and having fun, and also your management style. I, more and more, talking to other nonprofit leaders and having been a manager for many years myself, it doesn't really feel like a style anymore. It feels like just good advice. To figure out a way of working with your employees so that you're not breathing down their neck all the time. And so you're giving them freedom to create, you're giving them autonomy, you're giving them creativity, and you're building their sense of self-efficacy they're developing as human beings, if you can do that. And the outcome, counterintuitively to some people, is always better. Do you find that to be, do you find that to be true?
I do. And I don't feel I had to necessarily, as I said, I think that that's born of being a guide and in working in outdoor situations where you need to rely on people as equal members of the team. For example, we have our quarterly, when we look at our financials, our profit and loss statement, and I have every single member of our staff sit there and look over every single expense. Income item. And it's there are many reasons I do it. It's very helpful for their growth as in understanding finances.
Absolutely.
Profits for a decade and never understand financial statements, right? So there's a sense that they then are involved in understanding that. I think it's also good from an oversight perspective, you know, to see how money is being spent, how revenue is coming in. And then also, I think the people who work at Climate Ride, that they're more empowered in terms of just general financial knowledge, you know, in the nonprofit sector, in their own personal finances. So it's, these are like little growth things that I feel as a director, I want to be a part of them knowing how to do all of this. And then, yeah. you know, I've got to say, you know, we've got members of our staff who just come up with, you know, wonderful things. We've really been looking at how AI can help us as a small team. And so we have a staff member who's taken that on as his project. And so we have weekly sandboxing sections to work on what can help us be more productive, help our participants, you know, because AI is becoming a big part of many aspects of management. And so from that to just general creativity in terms of our merchandise, our participant support has greatly and vastly improved because of our participant management team. If they have an idea, I say, let's try it, always, is my first response.
There was fiction that I encountered many times in the software world, and that was the person who's the best technical person on the team should become the manager, right?
Yeah.
The problem with that is it's understandable, right? That you'd think, well, that's probably the default, but it shouldn't be the default because managers have to be good at human relationship things, at emotional intelligence things. And I knew plenty of tech people who weren't gifted with a lot of that and didn't have exposure to people who could help them with that. Mm-hmm. So I think that side of management is radically underappreciated. And this great about the way you're describing management is it's a positive way of motivating people. You can motivate people with fear. You know, when I was at Lotus IBM, we did that. Yeah. I didn't do that. Yeah. I was dead set against it. Fear is a good short-term motivator, contrary to popular belief. And there have been Harvard studies about this. Mm-hmm. But it's a terrible long-term motivator. And if you care about retention and you care about employee development and you care about all those things and you want your employees to be happy, you can't motivate people that way.
I know. I can't even imagine using that as a technique. I mean, I did get you to ride up that hill in Iceland, the fear of not making it to the top.
Oh, I don't, but I'm sure you're familiar with some fear techniques.
You know, it's that brings up another point, the idea of how challenges motivate people, but, you know, doing it within the realm of the positive and using encouragement as a tool.
Yeah.
You know, back to the part about staff and management, I mean, the team I get to work with, they make every day of work fun for me, you know, so it's a two-way street. And so I'm just so grateful.
Yeah. And it's a fiction that you have to know everything. No great manager can know everything, or that you have all of the attributes that the whole organization needs. The best leaders fill in the gaps of their own shortcomings. Let's say you're a great visionary, but you're not super organized. Well, you bring someone on board who's great at organizing and planning. Right?
You thank them every day because that
every day, every day, every day. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is you have a lot in common with other nonprofit, the best nonprofit leaders I've talked to, because they all say that. They all say, you know, how you develop your people, how you set up team culture is so, so important. One of my heroes, I've said this on probably half of my podcast, but it's such a great line. Pat Metheny once was asked, you know, how he was successful as a music leader. And his answer was, I always made sure I was the worst player in the band. Right?
That's great. And you're a musician. That really resonates with you.
Yeah. So he surrounded himself with great people. And, you know, it's great. The old thing about the teacher coming into the classroom and saying, I'm going to learn as much from you as you learn from me. That's a little bit of a cliche, right?
Yeah.
But learning should definitely be bi-directional, you know?
Sure, definitely.
Yeah,
well, you know, I was always, my dad used to always say to me when I would be writing papers, he'd say, everyone needs an editor, you know?
Right.
That stuck with me from a very young age that I might've thought what I was doing was so great, but everyone could use an editor, so.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I have the gift of brevity, but often I don't. So I always get someone to look at what I've written.
Right.
I was going to ask you about marketing and, you know, how you do marketing and how you raise money. But is that an important question for you? Because, I mean, it seems like how you raise money for beneficiaries is obvious. Mm-hmm. How do you keep the organization afloat financially? Like, what are the things that you've learned to do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, so earlier when you talked about challenges early on, you know, there's always been this thing about charitable events and sponsors. And I learned early on that often sponsors weren't really giving that much money, maybe some in-kind donations, and very few charitable events are actually fully underwritten by sponsors. And right. So in the early days of Climate Ride, you know, the first few years, we gave virtually everything away, and financially it was not sustainable at all.
Right.
And so a couple of rioters that I met said, I'd really like for your team, you know, let's all meet up and have a weekend session and really talk about this. And they said, there's no point to doing what you do if you can't keep doing it, you know?
Right.
So, and we were the ones putting on the events, and the beneficiaries that we give money to, they're not obligated to do anything. They don't have to take on any of the insurance or the cost to produce the events or the marketing of the events, any of that.
Right.
They simply get to benefit. We do ask them to please tell your networks, you know, that, uh-huh. that you're a beneficiary, because we have seen time and time again, someone who's a $50 donor to a nonprofit will come to a Climate Ride and then raise thousands, you know,
right.
So we've converted one of their donors into someone raising thousands of dollars for them.
Right.
So some of our beneficiaries now do engage on a deeper basis, but overall uh-huh. we were doing the work to create these grants literally out of nowhere. Okay. So
yeah.
they came up with this great concept of our proceeds would be 80% to our beneficiaries and 20% to support Climate Ride.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of like, wow, because
yeah.
that 20% in that, anyone here who does any kind of fundraising, you understand there's transaction fees, you know?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Now, you know, 15 years ago, people were not, you know, checking that box to cover their donation fees on anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Climate Ride, we cover all of those donation fees as well. So that was a big shift. So mm-hmm. a portion of proceeds due for every event, except for Green Fondo, because we give 100% because we fundraise to cover that, goes to support Climate Ride. And that
yeah.
has helped create a sustainable model for Climate Ride to exist.
Right.
But then as we started to do more and more things, I want to touch on sponsorship. A lot of grants or sponsorships are definitely driven by personal connections. That's another
mm-hmm.
piece of advice
yeah, sure.
young nonprofits or even
yeah.
mature ones. It takes a lot of networking to get to where these things matter. And the environmental nonprofits are even a more challenging situation because there are companies that simply are not mission aligned, you know,
mm-hmm.
or you, it would be problematic to take money from as a sponsor.
Right.
So
right.
greenwashing, all of that. So your donor pool, your sponsor pool is already so small if you're an environmental
mm-hmm.
group.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed to figure out a way to operate sustainability without dealing with the ebb and flow of sponsorship or actually
right.
potential crater of a sponsor pulling out of sponsoring your ride. So
yeah.
we've done that. And then as we wanted to implement more programs, we have an environmental justice and transportation access grants program, which we give $40,000 a year. I call it the no strings attached grants, because if you ever have tried to get a grant, you know, you're sitting there trying so hard for $5,000. And then the reporting that you have to do as a nonprofit takes up so much staff time that you're like, why
yeah.
did I even go for this? So we have a grant program that we give out eight $5,000 grants, and these groups are nominated by other people. They don't have to do anything. We just write them a happy email saying, here's $5,000. Go do your great work.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So how do we fundraise for that? So
yeah.
as Climate Ride has grown, we've need to find new ways to raise money. So we introduced what are called funders trips. So we have a handful of trips a year, four or five, where 100% of all the proceeds benefit Climate Ride directly. And so with those funders trips, and then a yearly annual fund campaign, we're able to raise enough money to help implement these new programs as well as cover our operational expenses.
Yeah. There's a Charity Navigator metric, and it's one of the most important ones, and I don't agree with it all the time, which is the percent of of money that goes to beneficiaries divided by your total revenue or something like that. So it's just what portion of your revenue is going to operating expense to sustain the organization and what portion is going to beneficiaries. You guys must be batting way above your weight on that one.
Yeah, we're doing quite well. And, you know, we have, as I said, a five-person staff doing all of this. So I'm just amazed by the output of our team. And we have had the benefit of being located in Montana, which was a fairly inexpensive place to live and work. And that's changing rapidly now since COVID. But when I look at upcoming challenges, I do think it's very important that people make a living wage and that their jobs are secure. And so these are things that the board and myself and our staff, we talk about as the landscape of what it costs to live in Montana changes.
Right. Right.
So, you know, that's definitely a reality, you know, in terms of continuing to fundraise money just to support Climate Ride itself.
Yeah. I meant to ask you earlier, and this is a radical aside or redirect, but do you guys have snow on the ground yet in Montana?
We do. We've had a very sad last few winters, but we had an early storm a week ago that dropped quite a bit of snow. So we haven't
Good
had any snow
you.
Since, but we're really excited. You know, just enough to Nordic ski would be great. Because
I love cross-country skiing. Yeah. I was a downhill skier. My wife introduced me to cross-country skiing, and I love it. The snow waxes and wanes here in the Boston area as well. But, you know, on years when we have a good snow, I have some friends that I go cross-country skiing with, and it's so much fun.
Yeah, my husband introduced me to it when we were first married, and it changed my life.
Yeah.
And so I'm passionate about it. My daughter is now quite the Nordic skier, so we go follow her around to races, which is really
fun. Here's another quick aside. So my brother lives in the Denver area, and he's a big skier, downhill skier. We grew up downhill skiing because we grew up for many years in Germany. Every time I go out there and we go to Breckenridge or Copper or wherever we go, I want to do at least 2 out of 5 days of cross-country skiing. Breckenridge is one of those places where they now have a fantastic cross-country school course. We finish that, and he goes, you know, my brother, and he's in very good shape, all sweat, no fun. Which I think is a raw way to look at it.
I always tell people, like, cycling in the winter.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Chip, we're doing our second Nordic ski camp here in the Whitefish, Montana area. So we actually have a Climate Ride event where you can cross-country ski for 3 days.
Wow.
It's really amazing.
That's cool.
And one of our great local coaches comes to the event to teach people. Yes, that's a kind of a new area we're going into, is this training camp idea, just on top of the biking and hiking and running trips. But here are some other things you might want to learn how to do.
Yeah. So tell me, you know, I don't want you to dread I hope you're dreading this question. I sent you some of the questions in advance, but what are some of the biggest mistakes you've made that have been impactful for you also in terms of learning?
The biggest mistakes. Okay. Let me think. Well, when I'll talk about event design, you know, when the first year when we were designing the New York to DC ride, you know, there was this pressure to create a bike ride that, you know, really went, like, literally riding your bike out of New York City, you know, across New Jersey. And I was put on a bicycle and I rode across the Pulaski Skyway.
I know what that is.
And I got across that bridge and I was like, this is a terrible idea. This was probably in 2007. We ended up taking a ferry out to Atlantic Highlands and then went into Jersey from there. So I think in terms of when we design rides and we do this as a team, and sometimes what one person thinks is a good idea, or maybe as a hardcore athlete, what you might think is not necessarily the best thing for the trip. Really learning as you go in terms of what's the best experience for people. You know, part of it is people have to be inspired by the event that they're on. You know, that's why our national parks events do such a great job, because it's life-changing to see these lands and our public lands. I already told you mistakes. I feel it was a mistake when I hired certain consultants.
Yeah.
But I was kind of told, hey, we've got the funds to do this. We should try this. And I was like, I don't know. But that's water under the bridge.
Sure.
Also, I think in terms of staff and hiring, there is a real thing, toxicity. Mm-hmm. I've worked in the leader world forever, where I've worked with hundreds and hundreds of leaders. But if your gut says someone is toxic, they probably are. Even if you're a young leader or a more mature leader, listen to your gut, because if you are the leader, that toxicity can be a problem for other people who don't feel empowered. Sure. Deal with it. I never see that in terms of the guests who come on Climate Ride. One great thing about taking an active travel experience, which goes back to part of the mission and what I wanted to do, because I worked in for-profit active travel for so long. How can we make this philanthropic, right? You know, people are doing this. They're going to go on these trips. But what if we made it so the money served the broader community? Mm-hmm. In that context, when you've got people on a ride doing something charitable, often people bring a better side of themselves, which I think is really wonderful.
Right.
There's a sense that I'm a part of a greater cause. So in my guide life and in my executive director life, I always believe in always give people a second chance, right? We have a philosophy on Climate Ride that if someone is having a bad moment on the bike, give them some energy chews. Or some water, because they're probably just need some sugar. I've learned a lot over the years. I would say that mistakes are meant to be learned from.
They are. And the reason I ask the question of everyone is because if you're not making mistakes, then you're not experimenting. And experimenting is what we do. We don't like to call it that because somehow it sounds inconclusive or risky. But experiments are important. That's how you make progress. And I'm talking about intelligent experiments, not just doing wild stuff.
Yeah,
a good example would be hiring a consultant. That's an experiment.
Or in our case, we've tried different types of events and said, you know, that was great, but maybe that's not the best choice moving forward. Or you mentioned marketing. I mean, for nonprofits, especially now that so much marketing is in the social media space, you know, these are expensive things to deal with. And so our team has been terrific about experimenting with certain things, evaluating that cost, and do we feel it's, you know, meaningful? Is it worth it? Sometimes we get it wrong, and then we figure out a right way forward. So any nonprofit, large or small, is going to deal with that.
Yeah. So last question, well, second to last question, what are three pieces of advice? And it's already implicit, I think, in some of the things you've said, but what are three pieces of advice you would give a nonprofit leader, particularly a young or new nonprofit leader, to move forward and be successful?
Wow. I think if you have, you know, I tell folks on our rides, a lot of people ask me, you know, you have a job in climate, you know, how did you do it? How'd you figure it out? And I'm a bike guide. So I took what I did then and converted it into something that serves the climate space. So to a young nonprofit leader or someone with an idea, it's not always a straight up climate thing, you know, or there's ways that you can serve your community that are different from what already exists. So I always tell people to have the confidence to pursue that. It does take a lot of confidence. You know, it takes a sense of, I believe in this. But then also evaluating, is it going to be financially viable? Which these are hard questions to answer early on. And what we discussed a lot earlier, is it going to make me happy to dedicate my life to this?
Right.
So I'm on 15 years of Climate Ride. I never expected this, you need to turn my passion into, I guess, what's considered a job, but it's mostly a passion. But, you know, seeking advice from both people who know you or people in your community who might have a greater sense of experience. I did that very much early on. People ask me if I'm a fundraiser, like, you know, do I think of myself as a professional fundraiser? No, but I do have to get comfortable with asking people for money. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I prefer to have people come on an event and see, you know, the special sauce, and then they get it, you know, it's a lot easier once you've seen it.
Sure.
But for people starting out, you know, if you have a vision, you know, I put together so many supporter kits and sponsorship kits early on, and I leveraged every single contact I had, every single person I went to college with, you know, their parents, everyone in the early days.
So yeah.
Don't be afraid to ask.
Ask. And, you know, what you discover is if it's a good ask, if it's a sincere ask, people want to help.
They do.
They really do. They want to help. You know, you just have to establish a little bit of trust and rapport, and then you're golden. Well, those were more than three, and combined with the other, and that's very good. And I like the idea of playing to your strengths, which is the first thing you mentioned, and making sure that you have organic passion for what you're going to do.
That's probably the number one thing.
Because that's the fuel, you know, when you're going up that really steep hill in Iceland, you know, that's like the little gel pack that, you know, is gonna get you to the top. You have to be passionate.
And that idea also of, you know, what I mentioned earlier about the percentage of giving just to environment, you know, a lot of people see that as a reason not to do anything. But when you look at that pie and you look at the 3% going to the environment, I'm looking at the other 97% and thinking, okay, you know, maybe some people would shift their priorities in giving, or overall this pie just keeps getting bigger. So I think it's a mindset too, in terms of what's the challenge, but then also, you know, at Climate Ride, we've donated over $14 million that would not have existed without these events and the people who do them. So that's, there's always opportunity.
Great. Well, Kaylee, thank you so much for your time today and your wisdom and your good experiences and your funny stories. And what's the best way for people to plug in to Climate Ride?
Definitely visit our website, climateride.org. Check it out. If you're curious what it's like, we've got a tab called What It's Like. And then also we post on Instagram. Great place to see pictures of events or things that we're interested in. So you can find us on social there. And if you're on the business side of thing, we're on LinkedIn as well. So it's a wonderful place. Yeah. But as I said, we've got a variety of events to kind of dip a toe in and get interested. So if you're new to Climate Ride, please join us.
Say unequivocally, you know, with four or five rides under my belt, it's absolutely worth it. It's so much fun. And by the way, you know, if I'm watching YouTube or looking for something on YouTube and an ad comes up, I'll skip it as soon as I get the chance. I've seen a couple of Climate Ride videos on YouTube that come up, and I always watch them all the way through, and it brings back fond memories.
I know, incredible memories. Thank you for coming back, and I will see you in Death Valley.
I hope so.
March. So
that would be fun.
And you know, Death Valley, that's the time of year when there's often a lot of flowers blooming in the desert. So maybe we'll get lucky.
Well, that's a good, I was a little bummed about Joshua Tree, but that's an excellent alternative.
Yes,
yeah. Indeed. And I've never been to either place. So that'll be a lot of fun. Okay. Well, take care of yourself, and more soon, I hope.
Thank you, Chip. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks again, Kaylee. Bye.
Bye.